Hello and welcome to A Pile of Cthulhu Behind the Bar with myself and Jay. Today we have the absolute pleasure of interviewing John from Tales of the Manticore. Would you like to say hello?
Hey there, guys. Hey, Matt. Hey, Jay. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. So we'll jump straight into it with the first question of what drink would A Pile of Cthulhu be if you could say it was a drink?
Could it be like a nice aged mezcal? That's what I'm into lately.
I have no idea what that is.
You need to find out. It's like a tequila.
Mezcal.
It's like a tequila. I think it's like one of those, all mezcals are tequilas, but not all tequilas are mezcals. Anyway, it's kind of like the whiskey of tequila. It's a sipping drink. It's a sipping slow drink.
Nice.
Not heard of that, but fair enough. We'll have to add that to the list for next year's meetup.
No, Matt. Mercy, please.
Never.
My liver.
We drank all of the suggestions from the past couple of years when we met up, and
at least a good majority. Service then with the new booze listings.
We.
Yeah. Right. We didn't get around to salmon vodka, and we never will.
Oh, we will. We will. We just need to buy it.
All right, then. So, tell us a bit about yourself, just in general.
I live in Toronto, in Canada, and I'm a retired high school teacher. My colleagues tell me I'm really bad at retirement because I keep on going back to work. These days, I guess I can call myself a full-time podcaster, and it's not because podcasting pays my bills, but because I have the time now to spend doing it. I have a huge love for classic RPGs. I'm one of those, you know, satanic panic D&D players that actually I gave it up for decades and then came back around about the pandemic, as so many people did, and came back with a vengeance. You know, my sort of first, last, and everything has got to be BX. It's basic D&D. I probably stopped playing that when I was 13 years old and went on to advanced D&D, and then second edition. But I've come back to it because it works really, really well for the audio medium because it's so simple. And I don't have to spend a lot of time talking about rules. Things like OSE, which are essentially the same thing, Lamentations, and even Shadow Dark to an extent, all of those kind of, those are my happy place.
Fair play. So with that then, what would you say your favorite TTRPG is?
To be honest, it's just BX. It really is just, it's just a retro clone. But it's got a lot of flavor and a lot of aesthetic.
Okay, so what led you to doing podcasts in general then, and why solo specifically?
Necessity is the mother of invention. So, a lot of people started their podcast or started their YouTube channel or whatever during the pandemic, and I was one of those as well. It's a story you've heard so often, I won't get into that so much. But basically, I had discovered a few podcasts that really kind of impressed me deeply. One of them was The Adventure Zone with the McElroy brothers, who, to be honest, were really just taking a big crap on Dungeons & Dragons. Which made sense to me, because as I say, I grew up with the stigma around it, and, I still am a fairly closeted RPGer. I don't tell my work colleagues about my hobby or anything. I'm pretty selective, mostly as a kind of a hangover from that stigma. Anyway, the McElroys were doing this thing where they're just having a laugh and really dunking on RPGs and D&D, but they made this thing with the Adventure Zone, I'm sure everyone's heard it by now, that was so good and so emotionally charged as well as being really, really funny, I came away from that going, oh my gosh, I find a lot more stuff like this. So I started looking, and I stumbled across a podcast called The Iron Realm. And The Iron Realm was a guy doing basic D&D solo, and he had like this deep, deep voice, and he really committed to the bit. It was kind of like the shadow knows. There was a persona in the narrator. And at one point, he did this thing where he like made a two-page short story vignette about his game that brought it to life. And I thought, this is amazing. I gotta find 20 more podcasts just like this. But I didn't find any more. He was the only one doing it. And then the pandemic really took hold, and we were all, sequestered in our apartments. I have a little studio here at my place, and I thought, well, maybe I'll make one. And so I tried to do it building upon what I had heard from him in terms of this kind of hybrid somewhere between an actual play and an audio drama, and then hoping to ring that emotional bell that the McElroy brothers were able to do so effectively on The Adventure Zone. I thought this could actually have some depth to it and be almost art, dare I say art. And so that's what I was going for when I started. Mostly I was learning as I went. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how to make a podcast. I didn't know how to launch it, how to host it. All of that stuff I learned by making mistakes, as many of us do. I look back on those early episodes. It's 5 years ago now. And they're like embarrassing baby pictures, but they also have to happen. So, I feel like, oh, my recent stuff is the stuff I'm really proud of. But a lot of people who enjoy my show, they love that early stuff. Maybe because it's got the honesty of having errors in it. And I was trying a voice at the time, too. I was trying to do this sort of like, deep persona, deep-voiced persona. At some point, I dropped that, too, because I became comfortable with my own voice on the mic. Anyway, long that was a long answer to a short question.
It's all good. I got into TTRPGs similarly. The Adventure Zone Season 1 was the first one I actually listened to.
Isn't it so... The balance is so... So, so good.
Yeah.
So good. They kind of lost me after that because they got into whimsical fantasy too much for me.
Yeah.
I kind of like a more Games of Thrones kind of vibe. Not that the balance had that, but I don't know. They were just so good. They are so good at what they do. I just loved it anyway.
Yeah, it was lightning in a bottle that first season.
Boy, oh boy. And now, of course, they can sell out concert halls.
Yeah. It's crazy to me that D&D or any TTRPG can sell out. Was it Madison Square Garden that one of the podcasts
sold out?
Is that
what Critical Role did? I'm not...
I think it might be in D20 or Critical Role, yeah.
I've tried to get into both of those shows, and I can't, mostly because I'm looking for that darker fantasy, especially nowadays where I'm aware of so much more to choose from. The Cthulhu podcast can be very dark as well, and so I've enjoyed quite a few of those for that reason.
I will say, I also didn't super get into Critical Role or D20. Mm-hmm. I tried those because they were the other two big ones after Taz.
Yeah.
They have a crossover one that's a little darker, where it starts with the premise that everyone is going to die, and they work back from there. It's a little quick one, but it's not bad. It's a little bit more murder-y.
What's that one called? Maybe I should give it a shot.
It's like Legends or Tales of Adventures. Nah, that's not it. Hold on, I'll find it. Yeah, that's a different podcast.
I have this funny story that when I launched my podcast, I didn't know what it was going to be, but I had these very strong convictions about what it shouldn't be, and I was like, there's going to be no tabaxis, and there's going to be no pun names, and there's definitely not going to be any fighters named Grog. And I didn't even know that was one of the names of the characters on Critical Role. T- totally unaware. It's just that I'd heard characters named Grog on about 24 podcasts, and I thought it's the laziest name I could think of. I think I may have actually gone in and edited that out since, because it really feels like a targeted attack, but it's not.
So how long have you ran Manticore for?
I've just passed my 5-year podcast anniversary, and it's gone by simultaneously quickly and slowly, because the episodes take forever to make, and there are a lot of them now. But at the same time, when I look back, it has gone by kind of in a blur. Kind of both. How about you guys? How long have you been running it?
About four years.
Nearly?
Near enough?
Well, 3.5-ish.
3 and a bit.
Yeah.
It does go by very quickly, surprisingly.
Started randomly, still going 3.5 years later.
So, what are the processes for each episode/season that you work on?
I do have a workflow now and a bit of a routine. So typically, when I get up in the morning, I'll get up early so that it's just me and there's no like noise of people making breakfast or whatever around. And the first thing I do is record like vocal takes from whatever script I've written the day before. And that's because in the morning the voice has like extra bass and resonance and just generally sounds better. And so I do all my recording in the morning, and I've learned through trial and error that for me I use a method called like punch and roll. So if I make mistakes as I go, I just say the line again, and then I say the line again, and then I say the line again, and then I edit it all later. It's just a little bit faster and more efficient than recording a take and going back and punching in where you're unhappy with delivery. And I'll do like placekeeper parts for voice actors, which these days I have quite a lot of now, but I'll just sort of use a kind of a flat robot-y voice so that there's a space in the recording software where I know, okay, there's going to be something that goes here later on. And then when that's done, I'll take a break, go for a walk, think about what's going to happen next, come back, and everything's frozen? No, unfrozen now. And then I'll write some script, and then I'll take another break, come back, and edit that script. And so typically I sort of attack the show in 30 or 40 minute packets. There's the recording vocals, editing vocals, writing script, and then there's editing that script, and then there's a whole bunch of things that are on top of that, like promotion, wrangling actors, maybe dealing with technical stuff, social media, all that other stuff. And so at the end of the day, it really is 2 to 3 hours a day, I would say.
Damn, man, that's.
While I was working, it was a lot to handle. It's much easier now.
That's a good chunk of the day to work on for. Wow.
Yeah.
Good on that.
Yeah, I probably make like a good 50 cents per hour.
I mean, it's something, At least it's something.
It keeps me in Mezcal, that's for sure.
Okay, we have to start finding that stuff. So, the reason we actually did bring you here...
Change your life.
...is about your game as well, One Shot in the Dark. Can you tell us a bit about it, for example? Why cards, not dice?
Yeah, it's the cards thing is... that takes its inspiration from a game called The Quiet Year. Are you familiar with The Quiet Year?
Yep.
By Avery Adler. Adler? Something like that. The Quiet Year is a game where you use a deck of cards and you pull the cards, and the cards give you prompts. Like, it's a story-building game and a map-making game. And the McElroy brothers have played this too, if it sounds familiar, but you can't quite place it. The card you pull might say something like, you see a bad omen, what is it? Or a stranger enters your community, what news do they bring? And so you pull these cards to generate some story elements. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I wonder if they could be like a solo dungeon crawler one-shot game that was like sort of true to the classical tropes of old Dungeons & Dragons and actually one-shottable, you know, like hour and a half. And then could I use this idea from The Quiet Year where you pull cards instead of rolling on tables and stuff? And the card mechanic is effective because as you pull the cards, they leave the deck. And so you can't, like with a table, you can roll the same number multiple times, but with the card draw system, you can't. And so what happens is that you can funnel down the experience to an ending. So you pull a card and it's going to give you a room in a dungeon, and then you pull another card and it give you another one, but eventually you will get to the end of that dungeon level because it's a card pulling system. And then the other thing was that I love the idea, again from The Quiet Year, of having a freeform map. A lot of the spaces don't say, you know, a 30 by 30 foot square drawn on a grid. It might just say torture chamber, one exit. And then you draw it however you want it to look. And is, you know, where are the doors? Makes no difference at all. You put them wherever you want. And so the game ends up becoming a doodle as well as a kind of a solo procedural game.
Yeah, sounds really neat.
I wanted it to fill some kind of niche when I made it, because I thought then, and I think even more now, there's so much out there that for people to make a game, there should be a space for it. And so I thought, well, there aren't any sort of like card drawing games for a dungeon crawler that I was aware of, and there are like very few one-shots that can be played as a one-shot. A lot of them just kind of go on and on and on. And so those were the two kind of reasons why I thought this could work, and also I had the show that I could promote it with. And I do think that if I didn't have Tale of the Manticore to support One Shot in the Dark, I'm sure it would have, you know, got fired out into space and lost in the crowd, because boy is there a lot of stuff out there.
You might like,
yeah,
if you're specifically looking for a dungeon type game that uses cards, you might like Abaddon then.
Abaddon?
Yeah.
Oh, let me make a note.
We did
of
try that one out ages ago.
Abaddon and the 13
I have become
series?
Aware of some of them.
We interviewed the creator a while back, but their game is completely card-based. It's generally a good game. A little tricky to learn here and there, but generally quite enjoyable.
Alright, I will definitely check that out.
I might be able to send you a PDF later on.
Cool.
Yeah. So, how long were you working on the game?
I think it's very short. I think the whole thing is about 18 pages, and that includes 3 pages of example play. I think it took a month to put it together. And again, I just like the podcast, I had no idea how to do that. And so I use Google Docs as my layout software. Game creators out there, don't do that. Don't make that mistake that I did. It's like terrible, terrible choice for laying out a game.
yeah, imagine using Google Docs to run your game.
Do not. I'm sure you guys don't know anything about that. Don't do it. Anyway.
Yeah, we've never done that.
I'm glad you're too wise to for that pitfall. I didn't know how to get art. I had no budget, zero budget, and so I thought, well, I was aware that you could get Creative Commons artwork out there, but I didn't really know how to find it. And so the artwork in the game could be improved. I'll say that the artwork in the game could be better. I ended up taking everything and putting it through some filters to give it at least a unified look. And I end up taking, you know, some photographs of dice and cards and stuff and putting those through the same filter to bring it all together. But when I came around to do the expansion for my show's 5-year anniversary, I was a bit better at this kind of thing, and so I was aware of things like stock art, which I didn't even know existed when I made One Shot in the Dark, and so the artwork is much, much improved for the second go-around. The cover is me holding a ruler with a piece of tape stuck to the end, kind of cut to a point, and then put through 129 different filters to give it a certain artistic quality, so that it kind of does look like pen and ink. But yeah, that's a picture of me back when I had long hair holding a ruler as a sword.
If it works, it works.
It did work. I still like that cover. It's the only art in that thing that I actually really like. And now actually trying to recreate that is very tough because, of course, all of the apps that I used back then are, you know, they're gone. They don't exist on the web anymore.
See, that's funny because, I mean, did you ever hear the story from, I think it was Bungie Studios when they were doing, have you ever played any of the Halo games?
Oh yeah, for sure.
So the voice module they used for Guilty Spark, they lost because the program disappeared. And it took them, I think it was like a couple of months to work out how to replicate it. It's funny that, you know, big creators, small creators, we all have the same problems. Whether it's a filter or internet issues.
Webcams.
What resources inspired you in making the game then? Any books or movies that led into this aesthetic of it and such?
Okay, so I've mentioned The Quiet Year. So that one, certainly an influence. The other one was kind of, I wanted it to feel like a BX game. And so it's chock-a-block with cliches and tropes, and I embraced all of that. So, like, is there green slime? There is green slime. Are there shriekers? You bet there are shriekers. And so everything that I could think of that was sort of, you know, just screamed that 10-year-old discovery of Dungeons & Dragons, I wanted those things to be in there. And if I could make it a game that felt like an Errol Lotus picture, then that was a success. And so it's slightly lighter in tone than, well, no, it's quite a bit lighter in tone than my show, but it's not a like a comedy game. Oddly, and this doesn't answer your question at all, but oddly it's become successful with kids, with like parents who want to bring their kids into RPGs. In fact, it had arguably been the most successful with that group, which was never the intention, but is a happy accident.
Fair enough.
See, that's quite good. There needs to be more games that are bringing the younger generations into this kind of thing, because there's a few, but there's not nearly as many as there should be. I mean, as a parent myself, I'd love to be able to have my kid to get into this and take on whatever mantle we end up creating, but it's just like there's this very far and few between.
Give it a shot, because I get emails all the time and photographs of people playing the game with their kids, and I remember the first times that happened, thinking, oh, that was not my intention at all, but cool, that's great. And then I got more and more, and now I think it's by far the most kind of feedback I get from the game is, oh, I played this with my kid, and maybe a screenshot of the map that they made with a bunch of monster doodles in it, and it's really heartwarming. Actually, I don't have kids, so had I set out to make a game for kids, I don't think I would have done as good a job as I did doing it by accident.
I mean, it is a delightful thing to share younger folks getting into the game. There's more of them now with the success of stuff like the it's the Critical Role, like Vox Machina cartoons and stuff.
Uh-huh.
D&D becoming a little bit more mainstream. I mean, the D&D movie was a pretty big success.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. D&D movie, I think, brought some kids in. I'm sure that was the goal of the movie.
So, can you get a bit into the mechanics of the game? A bit into the weeds?
Sure, yeah. I wanted it to be really simple. And so I tried to strip out as many mechanics as I could. And so I even though it's a solo game, you could play it with more than one person, but it's sort of designed for one person, but you get four players, one of each of the classical classes, a fighter, a magic user, a cleric, and a thief, and each of them gets a designated die. So the fighter gets a d8, the cleric gets a d6, and the wizard and the thief get a d4, and they use that die to roll to hit, and on a 4 or better, they hit. So the fighter has a little better than a 50% chance, whereas the magic user and the thief have a 25% chance to hit. And then they use that same die to roll damage. And so that's all of combat, really. The monsters will also have a designated die depending on how tough they are. And there's the attack die, and then there's hit points. And that's it. There's no armor class. There's no initiative. I just say that the player always goes first. And the mechanics for spells, likewise, are really, really simple. I say that you can use a spell instantaneously at any time. Once you've used it, it's gone forever, and you can never use that spell again. And it might give a buff or a debuff or do some damage or teleport you somewhere on the map, but everything is very, very simple, stripped down, minimal, and that's probably why people did use it with their kids and use it as a kind of introduction to more complex systems.
Yeah. So, by the sounds of it, it doesn't sound as if there's a lot of character creation in this. Is it just a kind of case of there are simple...
There's none.
Level ups at all?
There are level ups, so every character gets to add their designated die to their hit points at the end of each level. Spellcasters get one new spell. They can't double up, they can't use one that they've already used before on level up. And at the end of the third level, there's a boss fight. So basically it takes you to level 3, and then there's a fight. The game's pretty deadly. And quite swingy. There's some resource management, there's some luck involved. I tried to strike a balance there, and for One Shot in the Dark, I feel like I got lucky and found a balance pretty well. And then for the expansion, I think I maybe got a little bit closer. Because it is swingy, it's hard to control it completely, but I wanted a game that you could win, especially if you were smart with your resources, but that it wouldn't be guaranteed.
Sounds good. So what were the best and worst parts of making the game?
The worst
part...
It's got to be the layout. But again, that's mostly my fault. If I'd used a different piece of software, I wouldn't have the tearing your hair out experience of putting in a picture and having it create ripple effects in the entire document, sending everything into invisible borders and whatnot. When I did the expansion, I did it again because I already had the original. I thought it was really just a matter of replacing certain blocks, but even that was kind of a layout nightmare. Hats off to people that do layout well. It's probably an unsung skill. So that's probably the worst part. The best part is it's getting that feedback from people that say, hey, I played this with my kid and we had a great time, thank you so much. Or getting creative submissions from people. Like, people have made their own expansions for it. It turns out quite easy to make a module for this game just by substituting things that in the tables I've already provided with new things. And so every few months somebody will send me a one shot in the blank where they've, you know, one shot in the snow, one shot in the woods, that kind of thing. These happen quite often, and sometimes people write to me and say, oh, I've translated your rules into Danish, German, and most recently Portuguese. And actually, the Portuguese one is so good. Today or tomorrow, I think I'm going to put it up on DriveThruRPG because it looks amazing. The other ones, they just kind of sent me text files, and I can't read them, so I can't do the layout. Otherwise, I would do that too.
So it sounds like you're very willing then to have other people create things and expand the world that you've built.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I put out a module maker kit for free on DriveThruRPG, so that if anybody wants to do that, I thought I could give them a hand and help them to avoid certain pitfalls.
I was about to say, what kind of thing are you licensing are you putting out there for this? I mean, because a lot of times games put out like open licenses and things like
that. Yeah, it's an open license with encouragement. And if people wanted to sell the thing that they made, that's fine. Even the game itself, I almost put it out for free, and I didn't. I struggled over about that because I wanted it to be free, because all I really cared about was putting it in as many people's hands as possible. But I thought, when a game is free, at least it's been my experience, if a game is free, I don't value it at all, and it just goes into a pile of PDFs that I will probably never look at. And so, in order to avoid One Shot in the Dark ending up in a PDF graveyard, I thought, well, I'll put like a nominal fee on it. So I set it to like $1.50, and the expansion is 99 cents, and the module maker kit is free, because I couldn't in good conscience charge for that. It just didn't seem right. So I wanted it to be like dollar store cheap, but not free. I thought psychologically that makes a difference.
That genuinely does. I know what you mean. If you see something that looks like it's free, there's usually a case of, why is it free? You know, what's the reason it's free? There must be a reason. Oh, it can't be that good if it's free.
Right.
And it's a stickler that I think a lot of people fall for. That it's a shame, because there's a lot of games out there that are good.
It's a shame, yeah.
But then
there are
again, a lot
of really great free things out there.
Yeah, but at the same time, though, there are those ones that are probably best avoided.
I'm sure that there's the other end too, where something's really, really expensive and not good at all.
Oh, I'm sure I could probably find a few of those.
I ain't seen shit. Keeping my mouth shut.
Yep. I mean, well, you've already kind of answered about three questions in one there. Feedback and experience and kind of things like that. Can you share any specific memorable moments when you were creating the game, and like even from any of the feedback that you have received, is there anything specifically that springs to mind?
I'm trying to think of, well, yeah, let me, this will be an exclusive. Yeah, because it's a painful story for me to tell. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, if you're
okay with it.
So, when I was approaching the 5-year mark for my podcast, I started to think I should do something to celebrate my 5-year podcast anniversary. And if you have products on DriveThruRPG, you can also, you can run sales reports, and you know how many you've sold. And so I knew that One Shot was very, very close to going platinum. They have like achievement badges, copper, silver, electrum. No, silver, I forget. Silver, electrum, gold, platinum, and then it goes on to adamantium. I'm sure I'll never hit these stratospheric ones, but the game was doing really, really well. I was thrilled because I could see like, oh, it's a couple dozen away from going platinum, and if it sells at the rate that it usually does, then it will go there by the time I hit my 5-year podcast anniversary. So I'm going to celebrate going platinum by releasing an expansion module. And the expansion module would have like a loose tie into the show to kind of do some fan servicing, but you know, you wouldn't have to know the show to play it either, so that could kind of hopefully please everybody. Anyway, so I was logging in, waiting for the numbers to cross a threshold and go platinum, and one day it did, and I thought, there we go, it's time, I'm gonna put out my expansion, and I'll be able to say, you know, in celebration of going platinum, here is the new expansion to One Shot in the Dark. And the gold badge did not change to platinum. And I thought, okay, maybe there's a time delay. That's fine. So I waited a couple weeks, and it still did not change. So I eventually wrote to DriveThruRPG, and it turned out, and this is the sad and somewhat embarrassing part, there was a clerical error in which they added a 4 to a sales figure that turned 25 units into 425 units sold. Ooh. in a day.
And that's a big change.
Yes, that it hadn't flagged anything for them. They assumed I had done some kind of giveaway, which I hadn't. And in fact, I couldn't. I can't give away a product that I've been selling. That would kind of be insulting to anybody that buys it. I couldn't do that. So I knew that hadn't happened, and it was simply a clerical error on their part. Whoever was typing in the numbers was doing it by hand, and they added a 4. The upshot was that I was almost 400 units away from going platinum. And I knew that that was not, that although that might happen one day, it was not going to happen tomorrow or next week or next month. I'm not selling these things by the hundreds. I'm selling them maybe 50 a month, which to me is amazing. It's great. It's wonderful. Very satisfying. But not at the rate that would get me to that platinum. So anyway, I had egg on my face because I had told a few people what I was doing. Oh, I'm going to release this thing because my game has gone platinum. I legitimately thought that it had. But sadly, it had not. And would not for a while. And even, well, I haven't checked recently, but I think it still is not at that threshold to become platinum. Anyway, so I had to kind of change gears and say, oh, okay, this is not in celebration of going platinum. This is in celebration of hitting the 5-year podcast anniversary mark. At least I did have something to celebrate it with. And I, yeah, of course, I put it out there. But had I known what the actual numbers were, I probably would not have spent the 2 months to make the expansion module that I did, because the chance of it being successful is kind of a fraction of what I had thought it would be, because it is an expansion. You know, people that buy the original might buy the expansion, but people that haven't bought the original won't buy the expansion. So I thought, well, maybe this new module will do 10% of the numbers that the original rules did. And that's okay. But when I found out that the numbers had been entered in error, I thought, ah, it's not putting out my new child into the world with the greatest of prospects. Anyway, it was spilt milk at that time, and so and the work was done. The game was made. So, you know, I put on a smile and put it out there anyway, and best of luck to the expansion module.
You'll have to give us a link to that on DriveThru, and we'll stick it in the description below. see if we can help you get some of those numbers at least.
Everybody has to eat a little bit of crow every now and then, right?
Yeah, every now and then. So, Have you any ideas of new projects or new games or new things for the podcast even?
Always.
Might be coming up.
Always. I'm always trying to innovate the audio medium. The podcast really is my main thing. One Shot in the Dark has been fun, but it represents a small fraction of kind of what I do content-wise. I think it will be a long time before I put out another expansion. I'm certainly very willing, if people like continue to translate the game, I'm happy to promote that and put that out there as well. In terms of the podcast, though, I think I'm halfway through season 3. I'll probably be done in a year. After that, I don't know. I already have ideas for season 4 rolling around in my head. So I imagine that I will continue sort of working in, you know, the homebrew world that I've created and put out something. I'll probably do something that's a shift in tone. Season 3 became a bit more Dark Crystal-y kind of dark fantasy and less Game of Thrones-y dark fantasy than I had done in the past. Season 1 was like classical fantasy. Season 2 was horror fantasy. Season 3 is that kind of Dark Crystal weird, I don't want to say whimsical, weirder high fantasy. I could see season 4 being like extremely low fantasy grit. Low magic, low fantasy. I tend to want to do something quite different than what I've been working on because every season takes about 2 years.
Wow, that's makes a long sense. Time for a season.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's going to be a lot of work to put into that. I mean, congratulations to you for making it for 5 years. I mean, the amount of work you must put into making that, having it all sound as well as it, as good as it does, it's incredible. It's generally hats off to you, good sir.
Well, thanks. To be honest, it's a labor of love because it is work, and there are parts of it that are not so much fun. But mostly it's a hobby sandwich, you know, like I make quite a lot of the music for it myself, but I would make music anyway. So I just make music that I could use. And the gaming part of it is a lot of fun. I love the sort of the community feedback that I get. It's one of my favorite parts as a content creator. If you're lucky, you can get quite a lot of love from the RPG community. And I've gotten a lot of love from listeners. And it really is inspiring and keeps me fired up. And I don't know if I would do it if I didn't have that audience out there. I'm sure you guys can relate that the audience part of what we do as podcasters is a big part of it. And you know, as I think as a podcaster, every now and then everybody feels like they're screaming into the void, but
then
you get that email that says, hey, I loved your last show, keep it up, and you know, it kind of lifts your spirits and makes you feel good, and you know, you go back to it with renewed enthusiasm.
Yeah.
We could definitely do with a few more of those emails every now and again, that's for sure.
And not the weird hater ones, please.
Well, I suppose the last thing we really have to ask you is what kind of inspiration could you give to someone who's A, trying to make a game, and B, trying to make a podcast solo or otherwise?
Yeah, I've often, even on the show, encouraged people to make that thing. You know, we started off talking about the McElroys, so I'm going to bring it back to the McElroys. At one point, they had Lin-Manuel Miranda on their show, I think. And I think that is where I came across a quote of his that he says make the thing that, like, his advice to creators is to make the thing that you wish existed in the world but didn't. And that's one of the reasons why I got into making the show, is because I wanted to hear a show that I couldn't find anywhere, and so I ended up making it. And so I tell a lot of people that they should do the same thing. It's extremely satisfying to, like, especially after a while, you look back on a body of work and see what you've accomplished and the people that you've touched, and you know, if you're lucky, you look at your number of downloads, and it's a number that my brain can't even parse. How is it possible that this many people have listened to the show? It's I can't even understand it. It's like too big a number, which is a great problem to have, I suppose. But a lot of people have said, like, that they're inspired by the idea of having a hybrid semi-actual play, like, where it's not an actual play, but it's not an audio drama, it's something in the middle. And it really is like a brave new world of storytelling, because you're always right on the edge of the story. You don't know what's going to happen next as the author, so it's as exciting to make the story as it might be for somebody to hear the story. I don't know what's going to happen next either, and I don't know if the characters are going to live or die. So it's genuinely exciting. When there's battles, I'm genuinely nervous. If a character dies, I genuinely grieve, and you know, get very stressed out about things when those characters are in danger, and I bond with the characters just like in a real game. So I often tell people there is a lot of room in this semi-actual or hybrid space to make things. And over the years, some people have actually answered that call, and there are now not a lot, but a dozen or so podcasts that use that same hybrid approach, where it's not an actual play and it's not an audio drama, it's something in the middle. Legend of the Bones is one of those, Swords Against Madness, Stories from the First Watch, Legends from the Fireside, Echoes of Escheton, Myth and Moon. There's a bunch. Actually, we've just started a solo role players network. If your listeners want to check it out, it's soloroleplayersnetwork.com. You can tell we spent a lot of time working on the title.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah, and you can go there and sample a bunch of things. So, you know, if you like the idea of it, but you don't quite like what I do, then there's other flavors of the same kind of thing out there. And if you do like that kind of thing and want more of it, it's a great place to go and just find more stuff that is in that genre. But it's still a brand new genre, and there's still a lot of room for it. So people who want to write but have writer's block, or worry about, oh, I want to write, but I don't know if I can make a satisfying ending. That was always my thing, you know, half-written novel in the closet because I couldn't find an ending. This is the solution to that problem, is to tell a story procedurally, and there is no promise that it's going to end in any kind of way. And really, the excitement comes from, you know, not what clever way is the author going to resolve this conflict, but will these characters even survive, and what's going to happen next? It's a different experience, but for my money, even more exciting than reading a novel. Because a novel, you can often kind of guess what's going to happen at the end if you're paying attention, because the author is kind of bound. They have to provide a satisfying ending, and they have to drop some kind of clues as to how that might happen along the way. But with a procedural game, just like in a real game of, like any RPG, you don't know how it's going to end, and so that's where the excitement comes.
Yeah.
Nice one. Well, it's getting up to that hour mark. I'm going to have to say thank you very much for joining us, John. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Hopefully the internet issues haven't affected this too much. We'll soon find out. But is there anything you want to plug just before we finish, other than the Solo Network?
Yeah, so I plugged the network. I guess that is the new thing. And for anybody that is looking for a one-shot game that can be played with one or more people, One Shot in the Dark is available on DriveThruRPG for $1.50.
All links will be in the description below. Thank you very much for anyone who has listened. And yeah, I highly recommend checking this guy out. Absolutely amazing show, an amazing game. I've had a read through it. And yeah, until next time, thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.